And indeed, that's what's happened over the course of the last 5 weeks. The president's attention to the stimulus package and to the investment package have been reflected in the kinds of appropriations that will be forthcoming for communities and for cities. Like the president, all of us care about our country, about its communities, about both their promise and their peril. We're inspired by local examples of turnarounds, the national promise of Pittsburgh and Baltimore and Lowell in the east, of Indianapolis and Omaha in the heartland, of Seattle and Billings and Salt Lake in the west. But we've also seen the peril of heightened crime, of the plague, of drugs, of fear on the faces of the elderly, of neighborhoods that have lost their life force with churches closed and ball fields empty and downtown stores with empty windows and factories where weeds have overgrown the parking lots once full of the cars of hopeful workers, and communities of all sizes in all regions made up of people of all incomes and ages and races. For every example of civic cooperation, such as the Promise of Minneapolis or St. Paul, renowned for their civic virtue, there's another, the peril, where leaders glare across each a chasm at each other, a chasm of misunderstanding, even hatred, and just refuse to work together. For every Portland, Oregon, the Promise, striving to redesign its future, there's a community in peril that has surrendered to the larger forces of the global economy. For every city such as Fort Worth, the Promise, sustaining attractive, graceful, and life-enhancing neighborhoods, there's a community in peril where the elderly are afraid to walk to the corner store with their Social Security checks, and where children peek out of their windows to see if the drug pushers are still at the payphone across the street on the corner before they can go out to play. For every city such as Tampa, meeting its promise by building homes for people, matching CDBG funds in innovative ways with the capital of commercial bankers, there is the peril where the homeless look for a wind-free alcove in a department store, a sheltered stairwell, or a steam exhaust pipe to sleep through the frozen night. And for every community of promise, like Rockford, Illinois, where people have come together across traditional lines, there are communities in peril, where the slow burn of anger smolders, occasionally to flare into the terrible intensity of Los Angeles last spring. The morning after the civil disturbances broke out in Los Angeles last year, I called Mayor Bradley, a dear friend, simply to indicate sympathy that I knew many of us felt across the country, and also to offer any help. I spoke with Councilman Mike Hernandez, who I know is in the room, and they suggested that maybe it might be useful to come out and try to be helpful, at least where the Latino community was involved. I did, and was in town by late that afternoon, and I must tell you, what I smelled and felt on that occasion makes it possible for me to speak to you with a greater clarity than would have been possible before that. Indeed, I must say, I think that experience had a lot to do with my being willingness to change life as dramatically as accepting a cabinet position requires. What I saw was a city in which the smoke was everywhere. It smelled of burning wire and plastic. The smoke was so thick that it obscured the lights of a helicopter circling directly overhead. Sirens screamed every few seconds as strike teams of fire engines escorted by California Highway Patrol, literally convoys of 20 vehicles, the patrols to protect the firemen convoyed to the next fire. Pickup trucks were pulled up next to electronics stores. The glass fronts had been bashed in, and men hurriedly loaded VCRs and television sets into the pickup trucks, and there was no police anywhere in sight because they were strung too thin across the vast city. One man, an actor who was trying to be helpful, Edward James Olmos, came up to me as we went in to make a plea at a television station for people to observe the curfew and keep their children home. Said he had just come around the corner and had seen a teenager who had been shot. The young man had been shot in the head, and he was lying, arms wide, sprawled out on the city sidewalk, his eyes wide open, staring straight up, dead. The urban apocalypse, in a kind of smoky orange, an assault on all of the senses, people wide-eyed, all-out panic, just one more loud sound away. Well, that was Los Angeles that Thursday night. But it could be another city in America some other night. No, you say, no way. Can't happen. Los Angeles is that different. Well, Los Angeles is different. It's bigger. It's more diverse than most cities. It's rapper street smart, maybe a little tougher, maybe readier to take offense. No, you say, it couldn't happen in our city. Can't happen in Miami or in Atlanta or in Cleveland. Can't happen in Chicago or Detroit or Dallas, really. Can't happen, you say, not in Denver or Kansas City or Memphis, not in Charleston or Houston. Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe not the same form, maybe not the same intensity, maybe not the exact same cause of the flashpoint, but the white-hot intensity that became Los Angeles was the combustion of smoldering embers for a long time waiting to ignite, like piles of dry wood with red-hot coals underneath. Other American cities can ignite. Or maybe we'll call ourselves lucky as a nation, and they'll just continue to smolder away, quietly, out of everyday sight, taking a human toll at a slower rate. Just keep smoldering away. Why are our cities, why are our neighborhoods, why are too many of our communities smoldering? Well, perhaps it's first and foremost a matter of economics. Poverty in the United States became more widespread and more severe and more long-lasting during the 1980s than in most other Western democracies. The real wages for the average American worker declined by almost 10%. Real wages declined over the course of the 1980s, and as a result, living standards for many workers and their families declined. What's happened to our economy, to our workers, to their wages? Well, slower growth in national productivity, it touches people's lives. The loss of high-wage manufacturing jobs to overseas competition, it touches people's lives. The replacement with lower-wage service jobs touches people's lives. The use of part-time and contract workers touches people's lives. These are not just business page abstractions. These things come home to our neighborhoods and our communities. All of these combine to keep incomes down for young workers, for poor workers, and we ask, why are our cities smoldering? But perhaps it's a matter of race. It's not something we like to talk about. But America has yet to come to terms with race. We run from it frequently. We have 50 cities in America, over 100,000 population. Now, these are good-sized towns. 50 who now have populations that are over 50% African-American, Hispanic, and Asian. Among them are a number of cities whose populations are over 60% African-American, Asian, and Hispanic. Atlanta, Baltimore, Birmingham, Chicago, Detroit, El Paso, Hartford, Los Angeles, New Orleans, Oakland, Washington, D.C., and my own city, San Antonio. Detroit, for example, is almost 80% minority. It's the most segregated city in the United States. The white populations leave, some seeking the advantages of the suburbs, some fleeing a deteriorating, crime-ridden central core, and others escaping people, escaping the minority populations themselves. The result is desperation, distrust, and poor populations left behind to fend for themselves in racial enclaves. And we ask, why are our cities smoldering? Well, perhaps it's a matter of simple rage, of people who are angry beyond words. The drug-fed epidemic has resulted in a larger proportion of the U.S. population in jail than in any other country except South Africa. The lack of affordable housing is so severe that many urban poor must now spend as much as 70%, not 50, not 60, but 70% of the budget of the income on shelter. And the black infant mortality rate is worse than some third world countries. We live in an America where every day, 27 children die from poverty-related causes. My friends, all races, every part of the country. 10 young people are killed by guns, 30 are wounded, and 6 children commit suicide. Every day, over 1,500 children are incarcerated in adult jails. 2,700 teenagers get pregnant, and 1,500 teenagers drop out of school every day. No, it's not just Los Angeles. In the slow burn of hundreds of communities, we're reaping a harvest of inattention, of withdrawal, of our unwillingness or incapacity to invest in our people. No government, certainly not the federal government alone, can address such a wide range, broad and deep-seated series of problems confronting our country. The president has spoken of putting people first, and he has put forward an agenda to invest in people, but it is an agenda that must operate in partnership across governmental lines and with the private sector in order to be successful. The president's program, as Secretary Pena said so effectively before, stems not just from economic statistics, but from his own personal conviction about what the American people believe today. First of all, his assessment, and let me just say, the president, like you, has run for office, and there's a connection that's made with people, as you know, in the process of running for office. Hubert Humphrey once said that the business of running for president is a lot more than out there campaigning, asking for votes. It is the place where you get to see the breadth and complexity of America and really understand the problems that confront its people. And I know that Bill Clinton was changed as a man over the course of this campaign. People handed him notes that said, please do something. Don't have a job. Our community is changing. I can't succeed in this place. They handed him rosary beads. They handed him religious medals. They handed him religious cards with their personal plight scrawled on it. This is the impressions that he came away with from the campaign. And the American people are telling him today that this recovery is not reaching them, that the 60% of them believe that the recession is still underway. And they believe that the jobs portion of it is not reaching them. In fact, we have more Americans unemployed, some 9 million actual human beings unemployed right now, than at the low point of the recent recession. If this were a normal recovery, there'd be 3 million more Americans at work today than are actually at work. The president has responded. That's what the stimulus program is about. Some may quarrel with it. They say it's not necessary, but as I heard the president say the other day, those economists who are saying that have pretty good jobs, in contrast to an awful lot of other Americans who are without work.